We're back with another episode of your favourite European podcast. Is that a presumptuous thing to say?
My favourite podcast about Europe.
Oh, no, I was talking to the listener.
Oh, good. It is my favourite podcast about Europe, though.
Oh, that's really nice. I listened to another nice one this week, actually. It's a bit too early to give them a shout out there.
Whatever he was about to recommend, listeners, don't go and listen to it. Listen to this one.
It's true, because as usual, we're going to be bringing you chatter about various things that have been happening across this continent. Things that you might have slightly overlooked due to the C-word news and that election that I think might be happening soon on the other side of the Atlantic.
Oh, yeah.
We'll try even harder than normal not to mention that. This week, we're speaking to the journalist Arzu Gebula about the war that is currently taking place on the edge of Europe in the bordering region of Azerbaijan and Armenia, something that we've been wanting to cover since the fighting started in late September, but have only just got around to it. Stay tuned for that later on in the show. But before we get on to the serious stuff, how are you doing, Katie?
I'm good, thank you. I've been getting used to life under curfew. Main thing I've learned so far: if you are out at a bar or a restaurant at 8:30 p.m. and you need to rush home and get back in time for a curfew, of which there are several in place these days across Europe, it's really important that you don't eat anything with a lot of cheese in it. And I learned that the hard way this week because we went out for Mexican food and I had this really delicious cheesy quesadilla. And then suddenly it was 8:45 and we lived 20 minutes walk away. So we were like running home. And let me tell you, it nearly ended in a big pool of vomit. So don't do that.
That's disgusting. I mean, last week you opened the show with excrement and you need to...
This week vom.
Yeah, up your game.
Sorry. How are you?
I'm fine. I'm calmer this week after the European Parliament saved their reputation in my eyes and managed to vote against that bill that was going to ban the use of the words burgers and sausages, meaty words, for vegetarian replacement products. So,
victory for sanity.
Yeah, I breathed a sigh of relief when that news came through. Although I am still quite sad that the dairy alternative bill did go through. Did you know that already in Europe, they're not allowed to call drinks almond milk or soy yogurt? They're not allowed to use dairy terms for dairy alternatives.
Oh, what does it say on the packet?
It says things like oat drink or almond drink. And so that was already a law, but they've just strengthened it. You're not allowed to mention the dairy in it. You can't say yogurt style, and you can't even say like milk-free oat drink because it says milk.
It's like the Voldemort of the milk replacement world.
He who cannot be named.
Yeah.
Anyway, this week we are going to be having a loosely Catholic-themed Good Week, Bad Week. And I was wondering whether we should rename it Saints and Sinners.
Oh, love that.
Although, actually, it might feel a bit inappropriate when we get to it.
Let's do it anyway.
Good week, bad week.
Who's had a bad week?
I'm giving bad week to Poland, and just a warning, this is a pretty grim topic, and I am going to be talking about abortions, so if that's something that you might find upsetting, it might be good to skip forward about 6 or so minutes. Last Thursday, there was a ruling from Poland's Constitutional Court, which puts a near total ban on abortions. Poland already had some of the strictest legislation anywhere in Europe, and now women will only be allowed to have the procedure either if their life is put at risk by the pregnancy, or if the pregnancy is a result of rape or incest. Previously, women were allowed to terminate a pregnancy in cases when a serious defect had been detected in the fetus. And those kind of abortions previously made up something like 98% of all of the legal abortions happening in Poland. And it's those abortions that have now been found to be unconstitutional.
Why would the court come to this conclusion?
Well, the thing you have to understand is that this constitutional court has been stacked with judges that are sympathetic to the ruling party, Law and Justice. An idea which may sound vaguely familiar to listeners following court stories elsewhere in the world. And the ruling party in Poland, particularly its boss, Jarosław Kaczyński, he's been promising for a long time to tighten the legislation and to make this change so that abortions would not be allowed in the case of a severe defect in the fetus. What he has been arguing, and in fact what the court ruling says, is that if you abort a fetus that has a severe congenital problem, that is effectively a form of discrimination. It is denying life on the grounds of disability. They even described it as a kind of eugenics. But on the other side of that argument, you have people saying the babies born as a result of this law, they are going to have serious health problems and they are probably, a lot of them, going to die very early. And that is putting parents through huge amounts of trauma. It seems to those critics, and it seems to me actually, to be really deeply inhumane, as well as, you know, yet another restriction on what women can do with their bodies.
Why is this happening now? Like, is this a political distraction from the fact that COVID is going badly in Poland?
Yeah, a lot of people are asking this question. It might be a distraction. A lot of people are saying that probably, given that the government knew there were going to be protests about it, it's a good time to have it because protests are technically illegal right now. But yeah, the fact that protests are technically illegal, that hasn't stopped thousands of people from taking to the streets over the last few days in the face of police brutality in some cases, and also far-right thugs turning up to try and intimidate them. The other thing is that there's not going to be an election in Poland for a few years now. So it's not like the ruling party is really going to get punished for this at the polls. But it's very weird in general, because, I mean, in the general population in Poland, this is not a popular idea. This is, yes, one of the most Catholic countries in Europe still. But when you look at opinion polls, for years they have consistently shown that very few people are in favour of tightening the abortion laws. It's less than 20%. And the opposition to this court ruling, it's not just a kind of urban metropolitan thing. There have been big protests in lots of different cities over the last few days, but also things like there was this TV footage of some farmers like driving their tractors in this protest in support of women's rights. So it's a very weird thing.
Presumably there'll be an uptick in Polish women crossing the border to have abortions in other countries.
Yeah, I think that is definitely a pretty fair prediction to make.
If they have the resources.
Some of the protests have been carrying coat hangers as a symbol of, a really grim symbol of how dangerous illegal abortions can be for women that are desperate enough to have them. And in a lot of places, people have been graffitiing the phone numbers of organisations that help women to get abortions, either illegally or abroad. They've been spraying those phone numbers of those organisations onto church walls, which has been quite visually striking. Poland already only had about 2,000 legal abortions a year. Campaigners reckon that it's something like 10 times that happen illegally or abroad. And yeah, that's presumably only going to go up. There's not many places in Europe where the situation is worse, frankly, apart from Malta, which has a total ban. And Northern Ireland and Andorra and Liechtenstein are also up there on the anti-abortion podium. And it looks like Poland just climbed up a rank. Bad week.
Bad week.
Who has had a good week? Let's cheer up a little bit, shall we?
Yeah, it's been a good week for the Pope after a documentary about him was released in which he made the bombshell announcement that he supports civil unions for same-sex couples.
Woo!
He said that homosexuals have a right to be part of the family. They are children of God. And then what we have is a civil union law. That way, they are legally covered. Now, I imagine this is one of those stories that you haven't missed this week. It was pretty huge news that the Pope, the chief pastor of the Catholic Church, came out in support of LGBT people. It's a pretty incredible development, considering that as recently as 2003, there was an official decree from the Church opposing civil unions because they, quote, obscure basic moral value.
Wow, that is a turnaround.
It sure is. But there are a few caveats I should mention. Firstly, he didn't say that gay people should be allowed to marry in a church. So he was commenting on something out of his own jurisdiction.
How many countries in Europe do actually allow gay marriages?
16 at the moment in Europe allow marriage for same-sex couples, and a further 13 countries have legalized some form of a civil union. But there are still 15 European countries with a constitutional ban on same-sex marriage, and some of them are Catholic countries, including the aforementioned Poland.
Ah, Poland.
So could this latest intervention from the Pope do something to change that? I don't know. This statement predictably got rather a lot of pushback from many conservative voices in the Catholic Church. That's all been pretty predictable. But there was also some intrigue around the statement itself that was used in the documentary. And it's quite interesting, if a bit confusing. So do you mind if I dive into it? For a minute.
Do I have a choice?
No.
Okay.
So at first, the guy who made the documentary, he said that the quote supporting civil unions was made directly to him. But then some clever internet people did some detective work and found out that the quote seemed to come from an interview with a Mexican broadcaster from 2019, because these people on the internet noticed that the clip in the documentary was exactly the same setup with lighting, chair, the cross in the same place as an interview with a Mexican broadcaster from 2019. And a few days later, it was confirmed by the Mexican broadcaster, Televisa, that the quote indeed was taken out of their interview with the Pope, and that it hadn't been broadcast at the time because, according to one source at the broadcaster, the Vatican had filmed the interview with their own cameras and had cut out the bit about civil unions before handing the tape over to the Mexican broadcaster.
Interesting. So they, at the time, didn't want that out in the world.
Yeah, it would seem like that's at least someone at the Vatican, whether it was the Pope himself or some of the Vatican establishment. I'm making it sound really murky, aren't I? Someone didn't want it to be made public, at least yet. There's no denying that the Pope said it, although there is some evidence also to suggest from a transcript when you put it together of that original interview that the Pope actually said the two statements at different parts of the conversation and that they've been spliced together to make it seem more powerful, and that in the raw footage it was a bit more of a watered down message. That's the kind of weird intrigue around it. And we don't know how the filmmaker got the footage now and whether the Vatican or the Pope decided, yeah, actually, you can have this now, or whether he got it in more kind of a backroom way.
You're making them sound very shady again.
I'm just trying to add some drama.
It's the Vatican, it's fine.
All that aside, he supports the right of gay and lesbian people to be bound in civil union. And maybe this public support of LGBT people will do a little bit to help the case of LGBT people in the predominantly Catholic countries around the world, like Poland. Big parts of the Catholic Church still treat gay and lesbian people with quite a lot of contempt. So this is definitely a move in the right direction. And therefore, good week goes to the Pope.
Some lovely people have signed up to support the podcast this week. They are Brian Estabrook, Stephanie Benedict, Chloe Schaff, Natalie Lamprew, and Amy Murinaka. Thank you so much for helping us to make this hot mess of a podcast. If you enjoy listening to the show and you have a couple of euros or dollars or pounds a month to spare, we would love it if you could chip into our fund and become part of the really rather lovely and quite nerdy Facebook group that we have for our supporters. You can sign up to support us at patreon.com/Europeans Podcast.
We spoke to someone this week who didn't know what Patreon was, and it made us realise that not everyone lives in a podcasting bubble, so maybe we have to describe it a bit more.
Oh yeah, what is it?
It's a monthly subscription service where you can support small independent makers who make things that you like for free.
That makes it sound like we make like pottery or something, which I really like.
Maybe we should.
Small batch podcasts.
We could make mugs where like the handle of the mug was Angela Merkel's hands in that special V that she does.
Oh, the rhombus, the Merkel rhombus.
Oh, is it a rhombus? Yeah.
They would definitely leak and it would be very upsetting. We are heading east now to the very edge of Europe to talk about something that we probably should have talked about sooner, frankly. This podcast is a firm believer in the idea that Europe is a lot more than the 27 countries that make up the EU. There is a lot of Europe that isn't in the EU, and that includes Armenia. In a normal year, I think there would have been quite a lot of media coverage devoted to the fact that some pretty bad fighting has broken out between Armenia and its neighbour, Azerbaijan, over a region called Nagorno-Karabakh. Now, this might be total news to you. It's been quite hard for anything that isn't C-word related to catch the world's attention over the past few months. But we really thought it was worth us spending some time this week trying to get our head around what's going on there. This is a conflict that has broken out on the edge of Europe over the past month. But unless you're pretty into geopolitics, you might be forgiven for not actually having really heard much about it. So we rang up the journalist Arzu Gebuller. Arzu was born in Azerbaijan. She now lives in Turkey. She is a staunch defender of human rights, which hasn't always endeared her to Azerbaijan's authorities. You're going to hear her talking quite a lot about IDPs, which, in case you don't know, refers to internally displaced people.
Which means people who have had to flee their home but remain in their own country's borders. Yes?
Yeah.
Maybe it's patronizing of me to explain that, but I actually had to look it up. Arzu joined us down the line from Istanbul, and we should apologise in advance that her microphone cut out halfway through the recording. So the sound quality dips at a certain point in the interview. Bear with us, remote recording goes wrong sometimes. Here's the interview. I think we probably have quite a few listeners, maybe including myself, who don't know a huge amount about Azerbaijan and Armenia, and very little about this region in question, Nagorno-Karabakh. I was wondering whether we could start, before talking about the conflict, to talk more broadly about the region and its characteristics, its geography, its landscape. I thought that would be a nicer place to start than immediately going into the fighting.
Sure. Well, Caucasus, or Southern Caucasus, as we are often referred to, consists of, I guess, three countries. It's Georgia, Azerbaijan, and Armenia. We all are neighbors. So geographically, we share borders, except we do not have an open border with Armenia, clearly, because of the conflict. Landscape-wise, it's a beautiful geography, worth visiting and traveling. So if you've not been, I highly, highly recommend traveling. And culturally, I think, well, first of all, I guess the religions. We all share different religions. Azerbaijan is predominantly Muslim, Armenia and Georgia Christian. The culture is very colorful. One of my all-time favorite holidays in Azerbaijan is to celebrate the equinox, the March 21st. It's a really wonderful celebration, wonderful time when all the family members get together, or you spend it with your friends, and it's just a lot of food, a lot of desserts, and it's just the best.
Any festival that heavily features desserts, I'm very in favor of. You grew up during the last war between Azerbaijan and Armenia, this terrible war in the 1990s. And I read this very beautiful piece that you wrote about how people from your parents' generation would talk about what it was like before Armenians and Azerbaijanis hated each other. I'm guessing you yourself were too young to remember that, really.
Yeah, I mean, I was too young to remember, but I do remember still the stories, because I think the stories kind of stayed in the family. And until I was 16, I never really met anyone from Armenia. I was in an exchange program in the US, and there was an exchange student from Armenia in the same program. It was very interesting because, you know, how do you talk to someone that you've never met, and you kind of grew up in this environment where that person is described as an enemy? Do I talk to her now? Do I not talk to her? Do I keep my distance? Do I say something? So it creates this almost parallel world of people who once lived and were in touch with Armenians, and then people who were forced to leave their homes because of this conflict, and then our generation who kind of grew up seeing both.
So in the late 80s and the early 90s, there were a very tumultuous few years of war in this region. And it's over a bit of land that sits in Azerbaijan, but which houses mainly Armenians who live there. So how did that war eventually come to an end in the 90s?
So the war ended in 1994, and it ended bitterly. It ended bitterly for Azerbaijan, especially. I mean, you know, it didn't just lose control of Nagorno-Karabakh, but it also lost control of the seven adjacent territories where only Azerbaijanis lived. And losing that territory, having the influx of so many IDPs into the country, really ended bitterly for Azerbaijan. And I think a lot of what's happening today is linked to that, obviously, you know, having lost territory, having so many IDPs in the country, and not making much progress in terms of returning those territories has always been on the agenda of the government of Azerbaijan.
And just to be clear, we're talking about quite a lot of land and a lot of people, right? I think that region was formerly about 13% of Azerbaijan's land or something like that.
I mean, the percentage differs, but it was 16%. So some people report between 16 to 20%. And that's a big chunk. At the time, there were over 600,000 IDPs. That number obviously has changed given the years that have passed and all those families who've settled, and also, you know, children who grew up and had their own children and whatnot. So yes, a big part of land and also a very significant number of people displaced.
And a thing that I've been really trying to get my head around is like the role that those displaced people have in why the war is so popular today. That plays quite a big role in it, right? The fact that so many people lost their homes and have been living in pretty horrible situations since then.
Absolutely. I mean, one of the biggest sort of scenes that we're seeing right now in Azerbaijan is that every time the Ministry of Defense and the president reports on a new territory that has been returned to Azerbaijan through the military operation, it is celebrated across the country. And a lot of the people who celebrate, of course, are people who are from those territories. And one of the most popular things in the last 4 weeks has been to see how people who were called IDPs say on their Facebook profiles that I am no longer an IDP. My village has been returned, or my town is returned. And it's a really powerful message for them to say, because for all these years, they were IDPs. They didn't have their homes. They felt that they were forced out. But it really is a significant development in their lives.
And so where are we now? A new ceasefire came in this weekend. Does it have any chance of holding?
Well, it has already failed, because there have already been reports that both sides have violated the ceasefire. I'm not going to dwell into who violated first, because it's an ongoing debate on online and offline, with two sides blaming each other really all the time about who has violated the ceasefire first. But this is the third ceasefire that's been brokered by the US this time. And there was some hope that it will hold, but even though there is a ceasefire, unless the demands made by the government of Azerbaijan are met, the Azerbaijani army doesn't look like they will stop.
As you said, Azerbaijan lost the war in the 90s. Things have changed quite a lot. Like then, the government has made a lot of money out of oil and gas. It's been building up its military. Do you think it is prepared to just fight this until it takes full control of all of that land? And if that's the case, what could the human cost of all of that be?
Yes, you're absolutely right that Azerbaijan did get rich. There was this like pumped up rhetoric that, you know, our army is getting stronger. We're going to get our territories back if Armenia doesn't come to an agreement peacefully in Azerbaijan. So you have not only getting rich, you also have this like growing rhetoric about how the government and the army is going to take the territories back. I think at this point, it's very clear that with the equipment that it has, with the military technology that the Azerbaijani army possesses, they can go all the way to the end. The only question that is being asked right now is how they will get into the mountainous areas, because now that they've gotten four of the five regions, how they're going to get into Nagorno-Karabakh is a question. The human cost might be devastating. It's already a humanitarian crisis. And then in whatever context it's going to be over, I'm afraid in the absence of this dialogue that didn't exist between the people, I'm not sure how it's going to look for the people. You know, this is the most concerning part, to be honest with you.
Obviously, the rest of the world has been perhaps slightly more distracted than it might normally be because of a certain pandemic that is going on. Do you think that has changed how the two sides are behaving?
Both countries have been fighting COVID. Azerbaijan and Armenia were hit hard. And the fact that the leaders decided to go into war despite of the pandemic is probably quite telling to the fact that maybe had it not been global pandemic, maybe the decision would have been different. But COVID, US elections, EU being busy with what's happening inside the EU and what's happening in Belarus. And also overall, there's been a disengagement with Nagorno-Karabakh. For many years now, there's been this growing and growing frustration on the side of Azerbaijan that the negotiations are not leading anywhere.
Well, thank you so much, Arzu, for joining us this week to explain this pretty grim situation so clearly. We're really very grateful, and I'm sure our listeners will be too.
No, thank you for having me. And if anyone wants to read some objective take on Nagorno-Karabakh, I mean, it's always really hard for me to talk about the historical side of Nagorno-Karabakh because I'm still from Azerbaijan. But for an objective historical background, read Tom Deval, Black Garden. Check him out on Twitter. He's got really good analysis of what's happening now. And also Lawrence Brewers from Conciliation Resources, who actually just came up with a new book on Karabakh as well. So these are like the two independent researchers who've studied the conflict, who know the region really well, and who've been on top of their game.
A along with those great recommendations of Arzu's, it goes without saying that you should also follow her on Twitter. She is at Arzu Gebura. We will put a link in the show notes. And thank you so much to Monica Eleanor, listener of the show, for putting us in touch with Arzu. Isolation inspiration time. What have you been reading or watching this week?
I thought I would stay on my train of recommending things that everyone else watched like a year ago, so it's kind of pointless. But I finally got around to watching Killing Eve season 2.
Dominic!
I know, I think there's already been a third season, hasn't there? It's not out here. Actually, season 2 just came out on Videoland in the Netherlands, so that's why.
Okay.
So forgive me. But probably most people know what it is. It's about a serial killer who's being chased by an MI6 agent played by Sandra Oh, who is so brilliant.
Love her.
But there's a really nice episode in Amsterdam, which I obviously enjoyed because it's the city I live in, and because there's a scene where Villanelle, the serial killer, is hungover one morning and is woken up by bells.
Oh, that is nice.
Oh, there they are. Just on cue. I was listening really carefully and the bells weren't from my church. They weren't my nemesis bells, but I think they were the bells of the Oude Kerk, which is the church just around the corner, which I can also hear a bit more faintly from my bedroom window. But yeah, I'm sure everyone's already watched it now, so I'm sorry for making a mockery of this segment, but it's the truth. It's what I've been watching.
The Europeans, the podcast with its finger truly on the cultural pulse.
It does genuinely annoy me that we get everything here in the Netherlands like a year and a half after you get it in the UK or in America. And I really think streaming services need to get it together. I mean, I know Netflix have it together to some extent, but there's no way to buy these things legally. And I don't want to watch things illegally. So I wait patiently. Rant over.
BBC and other broadcasters, I hope you've heard this. Sort it out so that Dominic can stop making such irrelevant recommendations on this podcast.
Thank you. What has been inspiring your isolation, Katie?
I've got a juicy one this week. I've started watching Barbarians, the new German series on Netflix. And it's one of those things that I started watching because I thought it would be like a quite trashy distraction from the C word. But actually, it's just really good television. Have you heard about it?
No. What is it?
It's set in the year 9 AD in the Teutoburg Forest in northern-ish Germany. And it's about these Germanic tribes fighting back against the evil Roman occupying forces. Mm. The Romans were like really bad guys, by the way. I don't know if you knew that.
I heard it.
So I put it on thinking it might be fun in a kind of Game of Thrones-y kind of way. But actually, I found myself like super gripped by the story. The acting is pretty good. And half of it is in Latin, like actual Latin, which I think makes it the first Netflix show to be produced in Latin. Although I might be wrong about that.
Wow, that's cool. I'll probably watch it in like 3 years' time and then recommend it then.
The thing I really liked about it is that even though everything in 2020 is terrible, this show is a really nice reminder that in many ways, civilization has actually improved over the last 2,000 years, and we now have like toothpaste and stuff. It's good.
Sounds great. I've got quite a meaty happy ending for you this week. I wanted to tell you about a theatrical and provocative theft that took place in the German art world this week.
Mm-hmm. You posted about this on our Patreon group, but I have to confess I didn't click on the link. So I'm intrigued to hear about this.
Yeah, well, I only got 2 likes, so I thought I'd give it another go.
Should we really be celebrating burglaries, though?
I hear your criticism, and I don't condone stealing art or stealing anything, in fact, but bear with me. I thought at the very least it's a thought-provoking story to end the episode on a kind of happy note. We'll see. Anyway, a YouTube video was released this week from the Frankfurter Hauptschule, a German collective of provocative artists/pranksters. And their video was called Bad Boys Go Africa, after the German artist Joseph Beuys. It was a nice little pun. And it depicted a trio of artists over a soundtrack of that song Africa by Toto, stealing a Joseph Beuys artwork from an exhibition at the Staatstheater in Oberhausen. The video is kind of like a music video, and it's a funny, kitsch thing in which we see them first stealing the artwork and then travelling with it to Tanzania, where it's eventually handed over to a curator at the Iringa Boma Regional Museum and Cultural Centre in Tanzania, interspersed with lots of dancing and sun cream silliness. Are you still following?
Just about.
The video is really entertaining and it's a kind of satirical look at tourism and colonialism. It's made even more surreal because the piece of art they've stolen, entitled Capri Battery, consists of a yellow light bulb plugged into a lemon. So they're wandering around with this lemon and light bulb and it's all really weird. Anyway, as you might have guessed, this tongue-in-cheek intervention has a very serious message. It's making a point about the fact that German museums are full of artifacts, ethnographic collections, and even human remains taken from when Germany had colonies in Africa. The collective say they are taking this artwork to the former colony of Tanzania as a symbolic act of restitution. And as you might imagine, burglaries don't go down that well with the people who have been burgled, even if the thieves are making an important point about returning colonial plunder. The work was actually on loan to the Oberhausen Theatre from another museum.
Oh,
and
shit.
That museum's director was said to be pretty dismayed about the theft. But here comes the happy ending. It seems like it was all a prank. Just today, another video was uploaded, literally just a few hours ago, from the curator at the museum in Tanzania. And he says that the work that they are now housing is actually a replica. And that the original work is still in the theatre back in Oberhausen, sitting in a back room somewhere. So nobody needs to be upset. They can call off the police, who, according to the reports, had been informed. It's all okay. I'm sure all that's happened is a few people in powerful positions have had some sleepless nights. But it seems they were just trying to provoke some conversation, and provoke it they did. So happy ending.
What a responsibly performed prank.
It is, isn't it? It reminds me of, there was a happy ending I did years ago with another theatre art collective who faked some Picassos.
Picasso or something. Yeah.
And hid it under a tree and like lured journalists to get it. Do you remember that?
I do.
And then did a theatre performance about it.
I want to be an artist / prankster. That seems like the coolest job description going.
Maybe we could pivot the Europeans into... No.
We do both need employment. On a more serious note though, it feels like the whole like art and artifacts from ex-colonies is becoming quite a big thing again. And I feel like we should talk about it in more depth on the podcast at some point.
Yeah, it's been something on our list that we would like to cover because there's been a lot of stories in this area over the last few months. But that's all we've got time for this week. We'll be back next week with more tales from Europe. And in the meantime, why don't you send us an email? If you've got some feedback or just want to say hi, hello@europeanspodcast.com. Where else can they find us, Katie?
They can find us on Twitter @EuropeansPod, on Instagram @EuropeansPodcast, on Facebook, if they just type in the Europeans. Is there another one? No, we're not on TikTok yet, are we? We're too old.
Yes, we're too old.
Since we are old, I might as well go to bed because we're under curfew, so there's nothing else to do. We'll see you next week, everyone.
Hi.